for your contributions. And
now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Steve.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name's Steve. I am an alcoholic. And all the normal statements about I'm nervous and I don't do this all the time, so forgive me for that. I'd like to thank Bill and the Valley Group for welcoming me here tonight. It's a real privilege. Hopefully I can say a few things tonight that might help some of you. I know it's going to help me. It's always good to share my story and remember how I got here. You know, in looking back at my history, there's no real reason for me to have been an alcoholic. It was kind of an Ozzie and Harriet upbringing. But from an early childhood age, I felt apart from everybody else. The first time I remember ever having a drink, I was 13 years old, and was out with my dad, my uncle, and my brother on our ski boat. And at 13 years old, you know, I had full control over that boat. Very powerful boat, no speed limits. And it was at that point in time I had a beer. And the only reason I ever wanted to go on the boat again was maybe I could have another beer. I didn't care about driving it at 60 miles an hour or anything like that. Didn't really drink much after that until I got out of high school. And I discovered sex, drugs, and rock and roll in college. And in the process, dropped out of college, but it was okay. You know, everything was still working. They say this disease is fun, then fun with trouble, trouble with fun, and then just plain trouble. And I've got to admit, for a long time, I enjoyed my drinking. But somewhere in my early 30s, I would say, I lost the power to quit on my own will. But I didn't know it. I thought everything was okay. As time went on, you know, there became more and more trouble in my life. And I'm going to try and keep the drunkalogue pretty short. You know, there were evictions and power cutoffs and phone cutoffs and all that. I just thought it was my bad luck. And that as long as I could drink like I wanted to drink, everything was okay, really, you know. I got married. It was only about 3 years ago I finally sorted out what was wrong with that relationship. And forgive me, I should have given you my sobriety date. It was August 9th, 2010. God gave me a date that was easy to remember, 8-9-10. I guess he knew I might tend to forget. The marriage quickly disintegrated, and it took me working with a newcomer, helping him work the steps, that actually gave me the clarity I needed on what was wrong with my marriage. So 12-step work is crucial for my recovery. I don't do perhaps as much as I should, but I'm willing, and I think throughout this program, willingness is everything at every level. Towards the end of my drinking career, and I do call it a career, I'll tell you more about that later, but at the end of my career, I was drinking, I don't honestly know how much, somewhere on the order of a 1.75-liter squeeze bottle of vodka a day, along with 12 to 18 beers. At that point in time, I wasn't drinking to get drunk. I was just chasing normal, and I couldn't even get normal anymore. But I knew I could never quit, because any time I had ever tried to quit, I would get the seizures and wind up in the hospital with the DTs. I had no idea that there was any help available. I figured it was just my lot in life to try and eke out that hell, try and balance that hell for the rest of my life until I died. And finally, when I thought I was going to die, I asked for help, and I got some medical help. I did have a seizure the day before I went into rehab. That was nice. The experience I had in rehab was really more of one of safety. I was so foggy that my rehab didn't really do me much good. It gave me a safe place and forced me to go to meetings and get comfortable at meetings. So I was in awfully bad shape, physically, emotionally, and financially. And I got sober. And that was September 23rd, 2003, not 8, 9, 10. And for 5.5 years, I came to meetings, came to a lot of meetings, and stayed sober. But the only thing that kept me sober for that 5.5 year period was fear. I was just deadly afraid of going back into that physical state, that emotional state that had led me to seek help in the first place. I went to a lot of meetings for 5.5 years just because it was something to do. I never took a step, and I hung on. It was read earlier. I held on to that notion that somehow, someday, I would be able to control and enjoy my drinking. But over the course of time, the fear of drinking went away. And I was playing golf on a hot summer day, and a cute young girl with a golf cart full of ice-cold beer asked me if I wanted a beer. And it was like, yes, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. I didn't want her to think I had a problem, you know. And that started about a two-month run. And I quickly saw that same level of drinking rising up to me again. It was starting to be like a 24-hour-a-day obsession. That was about the time I realized that it was the obsession that was my problem. I came running back into these rooms, and it was my decision, and some of the things I say are about me. They're not necessarily line for line out of the big book. But when I came back in, I was willing. Because it really seemed to me that I did not have a solution. And even though I thought I was like terminally unique, I needed help. I knew everything, but I needed help. I waited 90 days, went to meeting every day, virtually, and got to know people in the rooms, and I identified an individual I thought would be a good sponsor, and after 90 days, he agreed to be my sponsor, and God bless him, he got me through the steps. At 3 months, though, however, I had a one-day relapse. So I had a drinking career that ended in 2003, and then I was called back as a consultant twice. The relapse I had at 3 months sober, a little over 6 years ago, I was at step three. And the thing about step three is most of my life I was an atheist. And as I matured, I became an antagonistic agnostic, I guess might be the way to phrase it. And I was at step three. And what am I to do? You know, I know I needed a power greater than, or knew I needed a power greater than myself. And I formed my own idea of God. But it was, in my experience, wrong. My attitude was that of, okay, God, I believe in you. Now watch what I can do. And within a day or two, I was struck drunk, and that was that one-day relapse. And my sponsor almost kicked me to the curb, but he kept me. We went back over the steps, and that one-day relapse was the day that proved to me that I was completely powerless over alcohol. The unmanageability of my life was easy to point out and realize. But that was the moment when it finally hit. Bang, I actually have this disease. I don't just admit it, I actually have it. And that was my bottom. My bottom wasn't in a hospital bed. It wasn't damn near being on the streets. It wasn't bankruptcy and losing a wife, losing a house, or anything like that. My bottom was when I realized that I actually have this disease, because that was when I began to recover. That was when I got step one right. Knock on wood. So if I actually am powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable, if I'm powerless, can it be a power less than me that solves my problem? No, I can't do it, so it obviously has to be a power greater than myself. So I pursued this program with everything I had. Step two is as I just described. Step three still took me a while, but I finally came to believe in an infinite God. And the problem I struggled with an infinite God is I kept thinking in the big sense. Big sense. Then the clarity finally came that an infinite God is big enough to include the infinitely small. And somewhere in there, I was somewhere in there. God was infinite enough to care about me. And at step three, when I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him, it was a big deal. You know, it really was for me. Some people's not so much, but for me it was a huge deal. One of the things I believe I've learned in here, and I point out to people, if I'm sitting on the couch watching TV, and I decide to go wash my car, and nighttime comes and my car's not washed and I'm sitting there watching TV, what have I actually decided to do? I've decided to sit there and watch TV, not wash my car. When I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, that decision means nothing without action. And today I believe that action is the only indicator I have of my decisions. So I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. But there were people around me who'd been through the steps, and they seemed to be happy, joyous, and free. So I approached the fourth step, not with fear and dread like I hear so many people. I approached it with, okay, let's get through this. I want what the people around me have, and my sponsor's willing to help me get there. He didn't tell me what to do. He just guided me through the book, kept it to the book, and made sure I didn't stray too far, you know? He'd been across the landmine, or the field of landmines, and a lot of other people in these rooms have crossed that minefield, and it seemed foolish given the fact that my best thinking got me here to think that I could cross a minefield unaided. So I took all the help I could get getting through the steps. A lot of people I have encountered, instead of making a searching and fearless moral inventory of themselves, they seem to be obsessed with making a perfect and all-inclusive moral inventory of themselves and never getting through it, never learning the tool. I learned the tool of the fourth step, and as things come up, I can process them. But the tool of the fourth step, to me, was to see how my instincts had gone awry and caused me troubles. And most of my troubles were generated by self-centered fear. And it's just pretty much that plain and simple. I could go on for a while about fear. But I've never experienced fear for recovery that wasn't self-centered. In recovery, I've actually learned to love people, and I fear for their well-being. And that's a huge shift in my way of looking at life. So the fourth step to me is important, very important, but it's just a tool. It's a tool to see why I'm disturbed. The fifth step, another one of those steps that some people seem to dread. I didn't. I wanted to get everything off my chest, you know. And when it was done, I felt like I'd rejoined the human race. I was no longer apart from the human race. I was a part of the human race. That I could look people in the eye and know that I'm not perfect and not have to pretend that I was perfect. I did a lot of that in my drinking career, pretending I was perfect. Knowing it all and coming into this program, needing help, realizing I did not know everything was a great gift. Once I got over thinking I knew everything, I became teachable. I was no longer terminally unique. So the fifth step really, really did wonders for me. I could look the world in the eye and face myself as I think I am, or I believe I am. Step six for me was, I think for me, even simpler than the book. Step six was just the fulcrum. Okay. I spent time in steps 1 through 5, exposing my past, revealing my defects. Do I want to go back to that, or do I want to move forward with the rest of the program? And I'd gotten so much relief out of the first 5 steps, so obviously I wanted to continue with the rest of the program. Step 7. What are one's shortcomings? What are my shortcomings? Well, self-centeredness, fear, egomaniac with an inferiority complex. That's something my sponsor who's here tonight taught me about. I've heard that phrase since I've been coming around these rooms, egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And you know what? Those are both extremes of self-centeredness. And I've experienced it, trust me. In my drinking career, I would think I was saying something clever to somebody so they would know who I was. When I was done talking to them or saying my sentence and inhaling, and they're waiting for their response, I was afraid they might see who I actually was. You know, just that quick. Egomaniac, inferiority complex in one breath. But the seventh step, letting go of my shortcomings. All my life I had shied away from relationships with people, from anything resembling spirituality. I focused on things technical because technical things didn't hurt my feelings. Most of my resentments in life were about getting my feelings hurt or not getting what I thought I deserved and people not meeting my expectations. Trying to think of what I was going to say, forgive me. Yes, one of my faults, one of my shortcomings, clear shortcomings in the fourth step, was that I judged other people by what they did. So-and-so did this, and so-and-so did that. I always judged myself by my intentions, not by what I actually did. And in the fourth step, I got to look at what I actually did rather than what I intended. And today I try and judge myself by what I actually do. But back to that seventh step. Exactly, what am I turning over to God? What shortcomings? I have an idea of what they are, but I sure don't know all of them. But one thing I know that all my shortcomings have in common is they block me from spiritual growth. That's That's the nutshell. If I'm disturbed, if I'm upset, if I'm overjoyed, if I'm vindictive, feeling sorry for myself, feeling too good about myself, it's probably blocking me from seeking God's purpose in whatever I'm encountering. I try not to let that happen, but I'm an alcoholic and I don't do anything perfectly. I couldn't even drink perfectly, but I did try, trust me. It was a tough 3 or 4 years before I first went to the hospital, just knowing that if I drank too much, wouldn't make it to work. If I didn't drink enough, I'd have a seizure before I left work. That was a pretty uncomfortable place. I don't have to live like that today. At the eighth step was crucial. Making the list is easy. The willingness seems more difficult, you know, for obvious reasons, our pride. But I found that from the fourth step, I could see where I had been wrong. You know, it's one thing to go to your ex-wife and say, "Hey, I'm sorry, I was jacked up. Sorry about that." That's not an amends. The amends was when I can tell the person why I did what I did, how my thinking was wrong, and how I'm trying to change. How can I make this right? It's not my bad. And so once I had clarity on my wrongs, the willingness flowed from the clarity of where I had been wrong. And the amends process, more is revealed. I haven't made the amends to my ex-wife. No good will come from it. But I now understand my part in it. It would be wrong for me to interject myself into her life after 13 years so I could feel better. Whoa. That's not exactly a sign of being better. It might also introduce her or reintroduce her to the life I have now with my new wife. No, I don't need to take her inventory. I'm sorry. But if anyone wants to hear it after the meeting, I'll share it. But actually knowing what I did wrong not only meant that I could ask honestly for an amends, but I could forgive myself. You know, if I keep doing the same thing over and over again in relationships and other aspects of my life, and it's not working out, and I keep wondering why, I'm going to drink. But when I have the tools that this program has given me to sort out the problems I have, I don't have to repeat my mistakes anymore. And the lesson I learned from my first marriage was where I had been wrong. You know, basically I entered the relationship on an entirely selfish basis. I expected her to take care of everything. Okay? Yeah. All we had in common was sex and alcohol. That, you know, it was a basis for a beautiful marriage. But you know, I definitely had a big, big part of the problems of that relationship. I resented her for 3 years because she didn't clean a dust bunny behind the bathroom door. Did it occur to me to sweep it up myself? No. It felt better to resent her for it. But these are the things that I've learned about myself. And the ninth step is freeing. It's very, very freeing. When you make those amends, your side of the street's clean, and often relationships that I thought were broken are restored. And people begin to trust me again. Some people I have to make it a living amends with. Myself and God, that doesn't get mentioned very often, but I need to forgive myself. I need to try and make a living amends to God. I remember right about the time I was at that point of my recovery, I was driving home from work, newly married, and my mother called me on the phone, Bluetooth nonsense, all that going on. She asked me what I was doing, and, you know, I've really tried to keep my sarcasm down tonight. She asked me what I was doing, and I said that I was going to the gym to work on my six-pack abs. But she heard six-pack. And immediately, she went, "Oh, no, you're not drinking again." And immediately, my ego flared up. It was just, clearly she doesn't know who I am. Then before I could say anything, well, you know what? She does know who I am. That question wasn't an accusation. It was a loving statement. And I've learned to realize that people who maybe accuse me of bad behavior, probably trying to help me, not criticize me. A lot of good comes out of the ninth step. It's an excellent demonstration of willingness. You know, step eight says we became willing. I became willing from the get-go once I actually got step one right. I stopped wondering why I was an alcoholic, because it didn't matter why I was an alcoholic. I am an alcoholic. Now, what am I going to do about it? To digress back to that first step again. As long as I was trying to figure out why I was an alcoholic, and some of you, I perceive, are new here. A lot of people came up. Good for you. When I was new, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out why I was an alcoholic. And all I was doing was looking for something I could fix so I could drink again. And when I stopped looking for why and got into the fact that I am, I entered into the solution, and that's where my recovery began. The tenth step takes me a lot of practice. Seeking through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him. Praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. When I was first at step 10, I did a lot of show me, a lot of praying. Show me what your will for me is. I was saying show me what your will is so much, I didn't shut up and listen. And to me, that's what meditation is listening. Listening and looking for God at work all around me. And a lot of things happen today that I can't understand. But I understand that God is in control of it all, and I trust Him. There's things going on in my life right now that during my drinking career, my only response would have been to curl up around a 1.75 liter bottle of vodka and go to oblivion until the things that are going on in my life, it either solved themselves or whatever, you know. If anyone wants to talk about the IRS later, we can do that too. But the thing is that the problems I have today are blessings. I'm not going to sit here and complain about all the stress in my life, because all the stress in my life, and there's a great deal of it, it's all trying for me to get the best blessings I can get, short of getting drunk over it, you know. Got a good job and working on a better job. I've sold a beautiful home. I'm trying to buy a new home. These things are all very stressful, but there's certainly nothing to complain about. I wouldn't have had any of this without AA and actually becoming normal, doing what other people did, saving money, paying bills, eliminating all those things that would close in around me and eventually catch me. today I'm not beyond being caught by something. Anything can happen any day. But today I can make plans. The trick for me is I do not project. At least not in my actions, in my mind. I project all sorts of bad things are going to happen. I'm going to lose both jobs. End up with two houses and they'll both get foreclosed on. And then I'll die. You know, that's me projecting. And I don't have to live based on my projections. I can plan and react to the reality that comes up. The reality is to be revealed, you know. I wouldn't be here tonight if I had a good history of predicting the future, you know. I just can't imagine I'd be here. I would have won the lottery and drank myself to death. That's what would have happened if I could predict the future. I think I got steps 10 and 11 backwards. Forgive me. Step 10 was continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. To me, it's not about making a simple mistake and fixing it. Oh, I added these numbers wrong in my checkbook. Sorry, and straightening it out. For me, the 10th step is all about letting go of old ideas, old beliefs, old ways of doing things when they quit working. I had to do that with alcoholism. What a concept. It's not working. Admit it. Do something about it. Today there are things that come up, and I, stubborn alcoholic, I want to hold on to things and have them go my way, and it should work. This should work. And it doesn't. And it's, I still sometimes have to get pretty beaten up or waxed into a corner before I let go of the old ideas. But that to me is the heart of the 10th step, is letting go of that which doesn't work. And the 11th step I've already talked about a little bit. It's not just asking, it's listening. And the answer doesn't always come right away. But I find that if I can just stay planning, yes, projecting, no, stay on the task on hand, the answers come. The next indicated thing will be revealed. And it's pretty cool. Sometimes the answer I get is just trust me from God. Sometimes the answer I get is go for it. Sometimes I get that innate sense of, boy, you better talk to somebody about it. And I've been around the rooms long enough. If I have an idea that I think is a little bit funny, and I talk to another alcoholic about it, they agree with me, I better talk to a third person, you know. We're all kind of messed up, but that's okay. The 12th step, I guess, is why I'm here tonight. It's been my privilege to sponsor four people, two of whom I'm happy to say are sober. One is still my sponsee. The other one who got sober decided he wanted another sponsor, and that's great. He is still sober. He's happy. He's married. He's turned his life around. My sponsee has done the same. Two people didn't make it yet. One just wasn't ready. Awfully young. At 21 years old, he hadn't spent enough time on the streets to think he had a problem. I think part of the problem I had sponsoring him was it was hard for me to relate to someone that much younger than me. Hard for me to give him stories about myself that made sense under his current circumstances. But he knows where the rooms are. And we see him riding around on his bike once in a while. And hey, give him the hey, you know, as he rides past our meeting in Kingsburg. The other sponsee that I lost is one I would like to bring up, because what happened to him, I've seen happen to other people. And I really want to hammer this home to anybody who's new. But I was working with him on step one. He was thinking about step two. You mean I'm crazy? Step two says that only a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. That means I'm crazy. Okay, let's stay at step one here. Maybe you'll agree that you're crazy. And so on down the line. And it was actually the ninth step that got him when he was at the eighth step. He was unwilling to become willing. And he kept projecting out how he was going to have to go apologize to all these people that he hated. He didn't understand that his hatred made them own him. Harboring a resentment is one of the things that I don't have to do anymore. And that was just his example out of step nine, but he kept trying to get one step ahead of where he was. I think he maybe was in a rush to say he was done or something like that, you know. But he could not stay where he needed to be. And if you're new, don't worry about step two until you got step one right and so on down the line. Because for me, once I got a step right, the next one fell out naturally. It just was clearly the next indicated thing to do. Tonight, I'm privileged to be here and share some experience, strength, and hope. I hope I've helped somebody here. I know it's helped me a lot. It's very good to see so many people that are newcomers and here. The person with the least amount of time in here is the most important person in the room. And can perhaps help me more than anybody else in the room. Just last night, I had to thank three newcomers at a meeting for reminding me of just how bad it is out there. I saw their emotional turmoil. I saw their hopelessness. And it reminded me of who and what I am. And I hope that I gave them some comfort that it will get better, some encouragement. And for everyone here, I want to thank you. I thank this group for welcoming me. Thank you, Bill, for inviting me. And I guess that's about it. I hope to keep coming back. Thank you.